Welcome to Thelema Now, a podcast about Aleister Crowley, ritual, and magic. Our guest today is Jeffrey James. And now here is your host, Frater Puck.
Do what thou wilt, shall we behold the law. Love is the law, love under will. Thank you, Jeffrey, for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, great. I have to say, I was actually really excited to do this podcast because one of the first books I got on Enochian magic was your Tangle Edition 1984 version of the Enochian Evocation of Dr. John Dee. And what I was most happy about at the time when I was just trying to get my head around what Enochian magic actually might be, because I had heard people talking about it as I was coming around and speaking to different occultists. What I was drawn to by your book was that it was structured as a grimoire, and being fascinated with grimoires, it gave, you know, grimoire meaning grammar, it gave me a way to try to get my head around how the system might actually work. What gave you the idea to actually come up with a grimoire? You know, what drew you to doing such a book?
At the time when I originally started working on the book, there were whole sections of Dee's manuscripts that had not been published. Most of them have since been brought into publication in various forms. And as I was going through the unpublished material, I noticed that he had made an attempt at kind of doing a grimoire, but it was sort of like a grimoire just for himself. In the sense that he knew where to find it if he wanted to practice a particular kind of magic. He knew where he could find it in his own notebooks. But he never really put it together for any sort of publication. The closest he got to it was a manuscript called Sloan Manuscript 3191, which has, it's kind of like got all the basic pieces of it, and he may have shown that. He took some time with it and used colors and, used colored inks and presented in a way probably meant perhaps to show to someone like Emperor Rudolph or some of the other historical figures who he shared his experiences and his knowledge with. But he never really collected it into a form that would make sense to anyone wanting to reproduce the magic. And as a result of that, a lot of misconceptions came up about how it was supposed to be practiced. So I intentionally took the model of a medieval Renaissance grimoire and took the material and put it into that format specifically to appeal to the kind of reader that you were, who would be able to more easily understand what Dee was all about if the material was presented in a form that was familiar to them.
Sure. Well, it definitely worked. I was actually surprised. I had gotten an advanced copy of the new edition. And what kind of prompted the discussion to put it out in this new edition with Weiser?
Well, do you still have the original edition?
Yep.
Okay. What really sparked it off is that copies were generally unavailable. When they were available for about $500 on a Libris. And as a result, that seemed to imply there was some demand for the book. Now, the original Heptangle edition in 84 there were two printings, both of about 1,000 copies, and it was done on acid-free paper on letterpress, which is where the type actually presses against the paper. It wasn't done photographically, and so it itself, the book is a work of art, and it's valuable as a collector's item just because of that. But it had also been republished by Llewellyn Books in the late 90s, and those copies were all going for $100 each. So that implied that there was a demand, and so they said, gee, there's people that want this book to the point where there's no copies available, and the copies that are available are going for large amounts of money. Therefore, there must be a latent demand for it. So it was a business decision on Weiser's part. I had always been planning on bringing it out and, you know, and keeping it in print as long as possible, first because writers want to have their books in print for as long as possible because they get royalties for them and things of that variety, but also because I think it still has a valuable role to play in understanding this particular system of magic.
Certainly, certainly. Obviously, Enochian is a technology that many different systems of for want of a better way of putting it, of occult attainment, appropriate. Enochian is used in many different systems, kind of ad hoc and perhaps not not using all the sources you were able to refer to when you first wrote your grimoire. How do you feel, just in general, about that kind of appropriation of the technology without necessarily seeing all the sources for it? Does it have a value or not?
That's an interesting question. I think that it's it really, it's really asking two questions. I think it's, does Enochian magic in its original form work, in a sense, does it, you know, do you get the effect, can you get the same results that John Dee got, and does other versions of it or other things that are derivative from it have the same effect or have some effect of some kind? I know that I have heard from many people who say that they have attempted Enochian magic in various shapes and forms and have gotten results that they consider satisfactory.
Right.
That's probably the best way to answer that particular one. I've also had people say that they like being able to have the option to practice it the way Dee intended it to be practiced, and probably the way that there was one Enochian magician after Dee called Elias Ashmole, who studied all the manuscripts and was coincidentally the first documented Freemason, I believe. And he probably did something along the same lines because he was closer to the actual tradition and closer to the actual kinds of ceremonies and thoughts that people would have had or preconceptions they would have had in the period. I think people enjoy the option of being able to attempt it as it would have been done in the Renaissance, and I think people also enjoy being able to see how that eventually turned into some of the more Baroque, that's really not the right term, but some of the more complicated forms of magic that later were based upon Dee's rather relatively simple system. I mean,
right.
The basic system is pretty, it's complicated in the sense that all magic of this sort has a lot of complexity built into it,
right.
But it's simple conceptually. There's elemental magic, there's zodiacal magic, the 12 signs of the zodiac, and there's planetary magic. Three systems of magic, and it's very specific about that, and each set covers different sorts of spirits and different sorts of angels and how to conjure them, and each is a complete system in and of itself, but they interlock because they deal in different areas.
The reason why I bring it up is, what is your familiarity with the vision and the voice, source of many essential spiritual doctrines of Thelema? That Aleister Crowley...
Wait a second, I got a copy of it here. Hang on. I have a fairly extensive Crowley library. Comes back to, but haven't really checked out that for a while. The first magic book I ever read was Magic in Theory and Practice, which was lent to me by a school chum when I was a freshman in high school. Years later, I ran into someone at a party who had been taught by that person. And just but I found the book in Virginia, and I ran into the person in California. It was all very, very odd coincidences and stuff. And the person I ran into was a guy named Ed Fitch, who's written a bunch of stuff on Wicca. And
right.
It's all this thing gets sort of tied together there. But I don't know exactly. I know that Crowley certainly had a lot of interest, in Enochian magic, and believed himself to be reincarnated from Edward Kelly. I'm not sure how serious he was in that. In maintaining
right. It's hard to be certain how serious he was about that. But
yeah, there was more than a little bit of a trickster god in him, as it were.
Right.
So you never really knew where it was coming from. Certainly the milieu that he came out of, the Golden Dawn milieu, it played an important role in terms of the seminal thinking of MacGregor Mathers and some of the people involved there. I believe one of the few recorded voices of Aleister Crowley that we have is him reading the Enochian calls.
That's right.
And, in fact, I posted one of those on the website for the book, which is rather unimaginatively EnochianEvocation.com.
Oh, that's the perfect name.
There's certainly an intersection points there. My feeling about Crowley is that he was very eclectic in terms of the sorts of things that he was interested in, and anything of that sort would draw him.
Sure.
But I think I see no sign of him having limited himself to that way of thinking. I don't think that he and John Dee necessarily would have gotten along too well, based upon my reading of their characters. John Dee did not have any of the trickster in him at all.
Right.
He was a very serious guy.
Yeah, a doctor and a scientist. You mentioned that he had basically written a grimoire for himself that only he would know where some of the references would be found, but not actually making a grimoire himself. Was it just the times? I know there was a period, it was still not known just how much involved in the occult he was, and then it became more known and it was somewhat controversial. Would you want to speculate as to...
He actually published very little in his lifetime, and so he tended not to publish. He tended to collect notes and write things privately. There's only a few publications that were known where things actually got printed. And much of his magic stuff was not intended for general consumption. He didn't see it as something that he was trying to promulgate. It was a set of experiments he was trying to do. He thought he was in touch with the angels that were going to create and generate and begin the end of the world. And he felt that he could, not that that was going to happen imminently, although he thought it might happen imminently, but that he would also be able to use that, his connection with them, to discover the secrets of alchemy and the ability to make planes to fly through the air and communicate vast distances and things like that. If you look at the catalog of the sort of things that the angels that he was talking about were promising to reveal, they were essentially promising to jumpstart 21st century civilization, only in the Elizabethan period. That was what he was about, and I don't think he saw that as something that would be served by a whole bunch of people knowing it. So he had no intention of publishing it or sharing it, really, with large numbers of people. If he was going to share it with anybody, it was going to be with someone who would give him the money that he needed to continue to pursue the studies and to support himself in a way that would keep him and his rather large family alive.
What are your thoughts on Edward Kelly in terms of, obviously, he was valued by John Dee, but was he a charlatan that just happened to be a good spirit medium, or the other way around? A spirit medium happened to be a really good charlatan.
I think people are kind of unfair to Edward Kelly because you kind of can't have it both ways. Either, okay, let's suppose that he made all that stuff up out of his head, all of it. So the Enochian calls, that he created a complete language out of his head with a grammar and syntax and vocabulary, that he dictated half of it forward, half of it backwards, that he was able to fake telekinesis in a way that would fool someone who knew more about stage magic than anyone else alive in his time. See, Dee knew all about stage magic because he'd worked on that when he was in school. I mean, either the guy was incredibly brilliant. If he was a faker, he was an incredible and made it all up, and he was like fooling Dee, then he was absolutely brilliant in doing it, to beyond the point, not just fooling him, but creating an entire language is not something that's easily done. It's not something, it's non-trivial. And what's interesting is when you contrast the works that Edward Kelly wrote himself, and it's strictly schoolboy Latin, simple English sentences, very turgid, very not at all interesting. There's now a chemical text that was published, I think, republished in the 1970s. That's basically unreadable. And then you compare it with the passages of incredible moving power that he got when he was scrying, and you say, okay, either the guy was an incredibly spontaneous, brilliant genius, or he was in touch with something else. But it's not fair to say he's just a charlatan, because if he's a charlatan, he was like world's greatest charlatan. Because he did more and more incredible stuff than anyone else could ever done in that area. You have to see this is where I think people get a little bit of confusion, because they don't really understand the importance of the Enochian language. Now, there are people like Donald Laycock, who wrote the Enochian Dictionary, and philologists who point out that the language is probably not what Dee thought it was, which was the original proto-language that was spoken in the Garden of Eden. That's probably not too likely, okay? But on the other hand, it is the only example in all of history that anyone has ever found where someone was speaking in tongues and speaking a language of which no one had ever heard of before. And so it at least sets a minimal standard for any kind of speaking in tongues, any kind of glossalia, any kind of situations where people believe they're communicating with spirits. Here's an example where at least a completely different language came out that no one has ever heard before. And that makes this system of magic and the records of the system of magic completely unique in the history of magic and religion. And that differentiates it from everything else.
You had mentioned a little bit when you first put the grimoire together was to reach out to people basically like how I was as a new student of the occult. But now that the new edition is coming out and there's all these other ways to get this material, obviously it's a business decision as well, but are you hoping that the Enochian system will be seen more seriously, kind of along the lines of what you just said, that there's enough compelling evidence? Obviously, practitioners are willing to work it, but outside of that circle, such as academia, for this to actually be studied?
I think it would be very interesting if academia in general would take a look at the grimoire as a branch of literature. Mm. They don't do that. They don't think of it as something. I mean, someone has to write these things.
Right.
Someone has to transmit them. Someone has to send. I mean, they study sermons as literature. They study theology as literature. They study, the things that people write on all different sorts of subjects. Philosophy as literature. And what is, no one's really studied the grimoires as a form of literature. And I think it's a shame because you see in them there's often material that's hundreds, if not thousands of years old inside them, and that have been handed down sort of in secret circles for years and years and years. It's a fascinating story that I think that gets missed because of the sensational nature of the promises contained inside the literature. But if you think about it, the promises are not at all out of line with promises that you might find in religious texts, really, and it's really not that unusual. So I think it's rather strange that it was never taken seriously as a form of literature. My main motivation for continuing to keep the material in print is that I just find the figure of Dr. John Dee fascinating, and the whole story is one of the key stories or myths of the beginnings of science and the intersection of magic and consciousness and the way people think and the way they view the world and the other world, as it were. And I find that, John Dee was the prototype for the character of Dr. Faustus in the play by Marlowe, and he was also the prototype of the character of Prospero in Shakespeare's The Tempest. He was this key seminal figure who I just think is until quite recently, been kind of given short shrift by historians and by scholars. And I think that I've kind of done what I could to help shift the view of what he did. In a sense, by taking here's the material that he wrote on magic, and here's the way it was intended to be used and the way it was intended to be thought of, so that people could look at it and say, gee, it was actually, as you were saying, it was a technology from a pre-technological period.
As far as practicing, should someone who is just starting pick up the Enochian evocation of Dr. John Dee as a starting point, or what would you recommend these days? In 1984, this might have been the best way to start, but would there be preliminaries that someone should consider maybe just to ramp up? From my own personal experience, I found Enochian to be quite efficacious, and perhaps it's not the first thing one should start with. However, I've also been chided for having that view. That's kind of silly, you know, what are you afraid of? Go for it. But what are your thoughts on that? Is there anything to be afraid of?
I'm thinking that was something that Israel Regardier said once, and that's anyone who undertakes magic should probably undergo psychotherapy first.
Right.
Fortunately, I'm old enough to actually have had a conversation with him, with Israel Regardier, which was it would have been back in the 70s. And although it wasn't on that subject, it was something quite a bit more silly. And maybe I'll tell you that story.
I'd love to hear about it.
I think that if you are mentally unbalanced, that practicing magic would definitely make you more mentally unbalanced. Just on a general principle, it's not there. It's in no shape, way, or form is it a therapy for someone who's mentally screwed up. Okay? I think for people who are fascinated by such things, trying them and seeing what sort of reaction you get from them, and being realistic about what you're going to get at them, because this is it's a mental technology, would be the best way to think about it. It's going to change your consciousness. I think. Expecting to get lifted up and carried away and, shot out the building or something like that is probably not too realistic under the circumstances. So you're really talking about technological ways to bend your mind without drugs, and ways to, you know, new ways to exteriorize parts of your character and examine them in different ways. It seems to be more in the nature of that kind of mental experiment rather than something that would actually, you know, impact the physical world. Oh, I could be wrong, but that is my main impression of it. So if I were starting out, I would probably start with something real simple, like Franz Barnes' Initiation into Hermetics, or something that really basic, and trying to understand, you know, kind of what this is about and how this works. That's probably where I would start if I were starting again. I started with Crowley, so, and started reading about that, and I think the first thing I ever tried along those lines was right out of the Equinox. I think I attempted as a, I think, freshman in college to do the Jupiter invocation from, I think, Volume 7 or Volume 6 or 7 of the Equinox. So, I mean, so people start in different places and try different things depending upon where they are in their lives. So I really don't have an answer to it. I did promise I'd tell you the story about Israel Regardie. When I was in high school, I read that he was a psychotherapist practicing in the Valley up in Los Angeles. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time, so I called information, and sure enough, there was a Dr. Regardie, so-and-so, so I called him, and he picked up. And
wow.
I said, gee, would you mind if I asked you a couple questions? And he said, sure, go ahead. And I went, I don't have any questions to pop right now. And he was really nice about it. He said, well, I'm sorry you don't have any questions to pop, as you put it right now. He said, but if you have any, you're perfectly free to call me back some other time. And that was the sum total of my, I had the great man there, and that's how I spent my, you know, my 30 seconds of brush with fame.
So you didn't call him back?
No, I never called him back. I was in high school. I was far too embarrassed to call him back.
Yeah. No, that's great anyway. So what are you going to work on next?
I am looking to right now to see whether there's demand to have a book on the history and practice of it published. Actually, I'd written one, and it was published under the rather unfortunate title called Angel Magic.
Okay.
And kind of given Llewellyn published it and gave it kind of a, you know, an angel-y, you know, like, you remember the angel craze in the 90s?
Sure.
Yeah, it kind of gave it that sort of twist, and which really dated it. But that also is in fairly high demand, oddly enough. And it's got some great material. It's got a more detailed description of kind of the background of Enochian magic, and has a more detailed description of a magical interpretation of the biography and kind of what was happening in that, of Dee's biography, and kind of what happened afterwards and how it all changed over time. So I'm looking to get that, see whether there's some demand to republish that. And I'm working on a novel about Dee's life. And that's, I'm working with an editor on that, and that's coming along quite nicely.
Now, we kind of touched on this before. I had asked you how dangerous Enochian might be. Again, I think your impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a very mental magic. How much of it would you say, in your opinion, is mental, and how much of it is outside the mental experience? How much of it is not human? Is this going on in the practitioner's head, or is it outside somewhat?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that what you're really asking is that, do I believe that non-human intelligences exist?
Right.
And are that's question one. And question two is this a method to cause them to manifest in some perceivable way? That's really what the question is. And I think the answer to that is, and probably the best way to answer that is, that the Enochian system of magic and the records of the ceremonies are, to date, the best scientific, such as it is, evidence that non-material intelligences exist. It is, as I say, the fact that it was an actual language that was dictated, that has no precedent. There are some indications in the language that it was not meant to be spoken, which is, again, something you would expect from an entity that did not have a vocal cord. there are some indications that the way it was put together, the way the language was put together, has things in the characteristics of the language that you would expect from something that did not exist as a human being on Earth. And because of that, it's, again, the best evidence that one would have of that kind of thing. So regardless of what I believe, would just be, you know, one person's opinion based on one person's subjective experience. I think that insofar as there's ever been any objective evidence that non-material intelligences exist, this is it.
Right.
There's no other evidence that I've seen that even comes close. Okay. 'Cause, you know, and you can quibble to the argument that the evidence isn't particularly good, but it's the best, certainly, that anyone's ever come up with. If that is the case, then clearly this would system would be the most likely way to cause those entities to manifest again. Obviously, they manifested based on it the first time, and you'd be speaking the language that those entities apparently speak. Therefore, this would be the way, if you wanted to manifest a non-material entity of some kind, this would clearly be the most likely research or most likely method that would cause that to happen.
One thing I was struck by, back to the idea of you writing a grimoire based on Dee's work that he didn't write, but you constructed much in the same way as other grimoires. What your thoughts might be as to how it's an inside look into how those grimoires, such as the Grand Grimoire, perhaps, might have been constructed. And as far as a field of study, do you see that that could actually be something that might actually be seen as valuable at some point?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact. I think that Dee was following in a long tradition. I don't think he did. I do not believe that he invented all of the scrying process and the keeping of records of what was seen and the generation of the magical sigils and the conjurations and things of that variety. I believe that he was probably the last practitioner of an oral transmission of how that had happened. I believe that he probably was able to pick up a thread of this is how it was done, based on the way people were talking of it from his time when he was at the University of Louvain, which he had just went there, like, I think, within 15 or 20 years after Cornelius Agrippa had been there. And so I think he was able to find out and was able, through his researches and through his understanding of what had gone before, that this is indeed the process by which this kind of grimoires are created. And so what we have in Dee's work and his notebooks and everything is all the background notes that would have existed inside somebody's library when they created something like the Grand Grimoire.
Right.
So that the fact that his survived, and of course they almost didn't survive, they were almost burnt as kindling. So the fact that they survived is pretty miraculous. I'd be real, since there are only about, I don't know, couldn't be more than a couple of dozen grimoires from that date, from before the Renaissance in their original form. There can't be that many of them. And the likelihood of finding those kind of detailed notes, again, is almost non-existent. So in a way, I was just like showing, okay, this is compared. This is what you end up with if you extract the material and turn it into a grimoire. So you can look at the Great Grimoire, the Book of Abermalen, or something like that, and you can walk back and say, oh, there must have been a body of material, a body of work relative to, you know, scrying activity and vision taking that preceded that from which it was created. Not all of them, though. I think in some cases it happened the other way. I think that once the grimoires came into publication, which I think really the first one would have been the middle of the 16th century, I think the fourth book of Cornelius Agrippa and the Heptameron were the first to actually be published. Once that happened, then the system would change, and probably in most cases people would say, oh, I'm going to write one. They just write one from scratch in the format that was already predetermined.
Right.
And that, so you have things like the fairy grimoires of the late 16th century, where there are, you know, books of how to conjure fairies and stuff like that are clearly derivative from the earlier works. The information was popular enough, and it was well known enough, so that when Marlowe wrote Dr. Faustus, he included little bits of conjurations that people would have recognized. Oh, that's from that kind of book that I looked at the other day, you know, because they were familiar enough with them so that people would know what he was referring to. So they had a certain popularity in their time. And in fact, in 1584, Michael Scott, who wrote The Discovery of Witchcraft, which is a book debunking all of this, very early book debunking witchcraft and debunking magic, quotes extensively from works and says that, you know, there were literally dozens of works available that people could look at from various authors and things of that variety. So it became a popular art form. It's almost all forgotten now, except for the ones that managed to survive into the Western occult tradition.
Central to Thelema is the vision of the voice, which I mentioned before, the source of many of the central spiritual doctrines of Thelema, and the 30 Enochian Aethers. It's attempted to be scribed by many Thelemites. And one thing I often hear is how difficult it is to get in the right frame of mind, or, I can't scry, or I don't see anything, or it's kind of a basic question, but I know some of our listeners may be interested in any advice. You know, you've obviously studied this for quite a while. You may have some tips that might be useful.
Well, the main thing about scrying is you have to plug, you know, the crystal ball into your USB port.
Okay. I knew that. I knew I was forgetting something.
Yeah, you don't do that. You're not going to. No, the problem that is involved there when people say that they can't scry or people say that that doesn't work for them is that they're expecting it to look like a television show.
Right.
They're expecting it to look like a movie where someone looks into a crystal stone and then inside you see like a little teeny tiny people doing things. You know, that's all convention in terms of being able to show something like that. And by the way, that's not new. At one point during Dee's work, they decided to use one of his sons, Arthur Dee, as a scryer. He was maybe 8 or 9 at the time, and he looked into the stone and he described some things that it looks like there's these little round things coming at me and da 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 da. And then eventually, Dee looked at it and noticed he was just seeing some bubbles inside the crystal. He was seeing. So he was making the same mistake. But the truth is that the visions occur in your mind and in your imagination. They don't occur as a physical thing that you actually see inside a stone. Actually, it might if you were schizophrenic. You might actually see things because schizophrenic people like literally see things. And I think it's probably occasion for worry if you actually saw little creatures inside the stone. You know, that's probably time to go get some meds because you're probably not too healthy if that's actually what's going on. You have to think of it more akin of a very kind, very focused sort of meditation, rather than something that's going to be like, you know, the magic out of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's just not how it is. It would be cool if it were. But it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's almost kind of strange. People say, well, you know, they kind of say, well, it's only in your head. What do you mean only? Hey, you know, what do you mean by that? What do you mean only? Everything's only in your head.
Yeah.
Everything you perceive about the world and everything it's all coming through your eyes, and your ears and through your brain. So that's all you've got anyway.
Yep.
So if you're playing with your head and playing with your brain and playing with the way that you think about things, you're playing with the essential of who you are in your universe. So it's almost like much more interesting than if it actually were exterior. I mean, if angels and demons were just not the kind of animal, they'd be studied by biologists, and they'd be in, you know, very boring books inside very boring libraries.
Any other tips that you would give? I mean, just in terms of getting your head around the system, you know, there's a lot of weapons, temple setup.
Enochian is actually relatively simple. As most systems go, I need a table but most of the stuff, most of the tablets can be made out of wax. That's actually not that expensive. You know, you sit there with a nice piece of wax and carve it away and rub a little ink into it. Can't be that complicated.
Sure.
At one point, there's a gold tablet that's needed at one point, but that's like only for one set of them. But if you're going to start the magic, I would probably start with the earliest form that was dictated, which is the planetary magic. which is one of the seven kings and seven princes. And that's probably the easiest one. And I don't believe that there's a great amount of equipment involved. I think you could do it pretty much with there wasn't a lot of detail, and D did not insist upon the level of complexity and picayune detail that often you find in other grimoires. It was pretty much, gee, we're going to do it tonight, whatever it's convenient. I think his thought was that most of these, you know, angels probably would come if you called, regardless of whether it was 2 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the evening. And I don't believe that he felt it was. There's not a lot of sign that he timed the ceremonies according to particular astrological events.
Right.
Although he did track astrological events, he did track everything that was going on. But if you read his diaries, he seemed to be more interested on the relationship between the position of the stars and his wife's menstruation than he was anything else, frankly, and whether she was going to get pregnant or not. He was more interested in, you know, when his kids were going to be born.
Right.
And when they were conceived. That was his interest in astrology more than seeing it as tying into the ceremony itself. So as they go, they're probably less complicated than other ones, so I don't think that an extraordinary amount of expense need be expended upon setting yourself up to do this kind of thing, if that's how you're so inclined.
Thank you very much for such an interesting discussion. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Just like to check out the website, which is I'm hoping to work on and continue to grow. It's called EnochianEvocation.com. And I have some things for sale on there that are kind of a little interesting. I've got 5 copies of that original Enochian Evocation, the Heptangle publication, in pristine, untouched, uncracked condition, given to me by the publisher, 30 years ago.
Wow,
so I've got those up for sale. So,
And
I'll inscribe them however you want, or leave them pristine as you choose.
That's great. I want to thank our guest, Jeffrey James, author of The Enochian Magic of Dr. John Dee and The Angel Summoner. You can reach Jeffrey at his website. Thank you for listening to Thelema Now.
You've been listening to Thelema Now, produced with the support of the Ordo Templi Orientis USA Grand Lodge. The opinions expressed on this program by the hosts and their guests are theirs alone and do not necessarily represent those of the Ordo Templi Orientis USA or any of its directors or officers. Our mission is to provide listeners with interesting, informative, and thought-provoking interviews featuring people involved in mysticism, spirituality, and magical theory and practice. Our theme music is provided by Fern Knight. You can hear more of Fern Knight at fernknight.com, and that is Fern Knight with a K. Our podcast producer is me, Zora Amy. And until next time, 93.